Hearing voices, are they real? Is it madness? Or is it the mark of the creative mind?
I remember once when I was giving a talk in a library, in fact, one of the audience members raised his hand and asked me if I meant that literally. You know, did I hear the voice with my ear as though it's outside me? Or was it more like I was hearing the voice inside my mind? And I explained to him that, you know, with characters, with fiction writing, it was more of an internal voice, but that I had had the experience of hearing a voice as though it's outside me. And then he explained that the reason he asked the question was because his son heard voices, and it was a very disturbing experience. The voices were very, very disturbing. And so I started to really think about this, you know, the almost spectrum between what we call, you know, sort of creativity and what we also call madness.
That's Ruth Ozeki. We talk with her about these questions and more as she tells us about her wonderful new novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness. Then writer Hilma Wolitzer also hears voices, the voices of her characters.
I always start with a voice. At the risk of sounding like Joan of Arc, I hear a voice in my head and the character speaks to me and sort of tells me the story. I really don't know what's going to happen until I start writing it. So it keeps me curious about the characters too. The characters just continue to live in your head. I say sometimes they should be paying rent.
We talk with Wolitzer in the second half of the show about a retrospective collection of stories, Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour, on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In Ruth Ozeki's new novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness, the objects around him speak to a boy, Benny O, who is grieving the loss of his father. The most central object is the book itself, which writes Benny's story, engaging in a heuristic dialogue with its young subject. The novel is a hero's journey and coming-of-age story that spins the tale of Benny and his also grieving mother, Annabelle, with compassion and wisdom. No surprise there, as Ozeki is a longtime practitioner of Zen Buddhism and has been a Zen priest since 2010. With its blend of sympathetic characters, riveting plot, and engagement with everything from jazz to climate change to our attachment to material possessions, The Book of Form and Emptiness is classic Ruth Ozeki, bold, wise, poignant, playful, humane, and heartbreaking. We spoke with Ozeki in 2013 about her third novel, A Tale for the Time Being, which was shortlisted for the 2013 Booker Prize. The Book of Form and Emptiness is her fourth novel. Ruth Ozeki, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Like Tale for the Time Being, which was another one of my very favorite novels, just like this one is, this is a title informed by Zen Buddhism, even more directly so. You're a Zen priest, and of course the novel is far from a religious text in any way, but tell us a little bit about the connection to Zen of the title.
Sure. Yeah. The phrase, well, so the title is The Book of Form and Emptiness. And the phrase form and emptiness comes from a very sort of foundational sutra called the Heart Sutra. And there's a sort of refrain in it that says form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And so this is a sutra that is, it's one of the so-called wisdom teachings, and it's a very central sutra in the tradition, Zen tradition that I practice in. And, you know, the word emptiness is a little bit misleading here, or not misleading, but it doesn't mean exactly what it seems to mean. It's not emptiness in the, you know, in the way that we understand it normally. Rather, it's this idea that all things, all people, all beings are empty of a self that is permanent, right? So it's another way of talking about impermanence, and it's also a way of talking about you know, the radical kind of interconnectedness of all things in the world. And a simple metaphor for this, I always think, is that metaphor of the wave, right? The relationship between the wave and the ocean, you know, and so, you know, you can imagine, you can picture the ocean, you know, sort of out there, you know, very flat, very still. And then suddenly a wave starts to build, right? And the wave, you know, is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it kind of pops its little head up and it looks around at the ocean and thinks, you know, thinks, wow, this is fantastic. You know, I'm really something, right? I'm really something. I'm a wave. Look at me, right? And the wave, of course, thinks that it's going to last forever. It thinks that it's, you know, it's like a real thing that you know, truly exists. And it does, right? Until it starts to, you know, subside back into the ocean again. And then it's like, oh no, you know, help, you know, and it, you know, it sort of subsides back into the ocean and becomes part of the ocean again. And that, you know, that describes basically everything that exists. You know, we're all like that. Things are like that. People are like that. You know, beings are like that. And so, you know, this idea that we have, you know, we have distinct forms, you know, you and me are, you know, we're distinct forms, but that's not all we are, right? We're also part of this greater whole. And I think that's where the emptiness comes in, right? So this tension between form and emptiness. And that's really the, you know, that's what's behind the title.
That really points to the central theme of the book. You know, I have to confess that the novel moved me literally to tears. I mean, I was weeping at the end, because I become so invested in these two main characters, Benny O and his mother, Annabelle. Tell us about them.
Sure. When the book starts, Benny is 12 years old. And the first thing that happens in the book is that he loses his father in a really tragic and kind of stupid accident. His father is run over by a truck in a really, you know, kind of unnecessary way. And Benny sees this. He sees his father, you know, in the aftermath of this, lying in the alleyway right before his dad dies. And so he's quite traumatized. And after that, after his dad dies, he starts to hear his dad's voice calling to him, calling his name, right? And this lasts for a little while, and then eventually he stops hearing his dad, but he starts hearing the voices of the things in the world, right? All of the things in his house start to speak to him. And he doesn't quite understand what they're saying, but he understands sort of the feeling tone behind these voices that he's hearing. And of course, this gets him into all sorts of trouble. You know, he lands, you know, in a psychiatric ward. He's diagnosed and he's medicated, and eventually finds his way to a large public library where he kind of takes refuge from the world there. Because of course, libraries are quiet places, right? And there are lots of objects, there are lots of things that speak in libraries, but they know to speak in their library voices, you know, so they're quiet. And Benny finds this to be a very, you know, soothing kind of place. And he meets a cast of characters, the denizens of the library there. And one of them is a performance artist, a young performance artist who he falls in love with. And he meets this kind of homeless Slovenian poet philosopher who holds literary salons in the, you know, in the men's washroom. And then he meets a very special talking object, which is his book, you know, his very own book. And his book starts to speak to him and starts to narrate his life. And so the entire, you know, the Book of Form and Emptiness is narrated by the book itself. And the whole story is set up as a dialogue between Benny and his book. And little by little, you know, the book and these other friends teach Benny they help him find his own voice, and they teach him how to listen to the things that really matter. So that's kind of the Benny story. And then there's the additional story of Benny's mom, Annabelle, who was very much in love with her husband. And when Kenji, her husband, dies, is really, again, just traumatized and distraught. And she's a media monitor. who is sent to work from home. And so she spends her days listening to the radio, you know, taping the radio, taping television, and clipping, you know, newspapers. And again, so she's just overwhelmed by voices. And she's also a bit of a collector. You know, you could say that she's actually more of a hoarder, but she really senses the beauty in objects and becomes very attached to them. And so their house is filled with things that she's collected. And Benny, of course, who can hear all of these things speaking to him, finds this to be a very cacophonous place. And in comparison to that, you know, finds the library to be very soothing. So it's really about the relationship between Benny and his mom and their father, who is Benny's father, who's passed away, and also these friends of Benny's who help him, you know, in the library.
Yes, it's very much of a hero's journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Annabelle, to a lesser extent, Benny really front and center in that way, and all these helping characters. So I want to get back to them and explore them a little bit more later. But first, this whole idea of the voices, mm-hmm. because one of the things that the book says and that Benny says is that, and that the poet philosopher Slavo say, is that the central question of the book, or the central question that Benny comes up with, is what is real? And you did a bunch of research into hearing voices, you know, as a psychological phenomenon. The book mentions that Mahatma Gandhi and Sigmund Freud and other notables heard voices. I didn't know if that was true or not, but I assumed it was. So talk about this whole idea about what is real in this book when we're talking about voices.
Well, the way it relates to voices is, you know, I had an experience that was similar to Benny's. You know, after my own dad died, I would occasionally, you know, I'd be doing something like, I don't know, folding the laundry or doing the dishes, and I'd hear his voice. He'd say my name, right? And it really sounded like he was in the room behind me, right? And I would whip around, and of course, he wouldn't be there because he had died. And so this was, you know, a very disorienting experience, you know, and every time this would happen, of course, I would feel that sense of, you know, loss and grief all over again. And I think it must have happened maybe half a dozen times in about, over the course of about a year. And then little by little, it stopped. And that was its own kind of loss. And every time this happened, it was very brief, right? And so I kind of didn't think much about it. It just happened and then it didn't happen. And I would kind of shake my head and, you know, and go on, right? And then later I discovered that, in fact, this is not uncommon for people to hear the voice of a loved one, you know, who's passed on. And so that was interesting to me, you know, is that voice real? Right? I don't know.
It's happened to me.
Has it? Okay. Yeah. And so, you know, in our culture, you know, in other cultures, you know, nobody would think anything of this, right? But in our Western medicalized culture, you know, you tell people that you hear voices and immediately, you know, it's pathologized. And so I started thinking about this, right? And I started thinking about the relationship between that kind of voice hearing and the kind of voice hearing that we as writers do all the time, right? I always talk about how characters come to me as voices. And I remember once when I was giving a talk in a library, in fact, one of the audience members raised his hand and asked me if I meant that literally. You know, did I hear the voice with my ear as though it's outside me? Or was it more like I was hearing the voice inside my mind? And I explained to him that, you know, with characters, with fiction writing, it was more of an internal voice, but that I had had the experience of hearing a voice as though it's outside me. And then he explained that the reason he asked the question was because his son heard voices, and it was a very disturbing experience. The voices were very, very disturbing. And so I started to really think about this, you know, the almost spectrum between what we call, you know, sort of creativity and what we also call madness, right? And when is a voice comforting and when is a voice disturbing, you know, and how do we relate to these voices that we hear? Because again, as writers, we have all sorts of very harsh internalized voices, don't we? Voices that are telling us that, you know, our work sucks, you know?
Exactly.
And Ruth, you're a traitor, you know, you should just stop and get a real job. You know, if you were a responsible human being, you know, I could go on and on. I mean, these voices, you know, they exist in multitudes in my head. And I think all creative people, and not just creative people, I think we all hear these voices, right? And so this is the territory that I wanted to explore in the book. Where on this spectrum do we lie as individuals? And how can we expand the definition of normal, right? Because I think it's actually, you know, a far more normal experience to hear voices of some kind, but we've pathologized them, and we have a very, very narrow definition of what normal is. And I think that's destructive. I'm really all for, you know, in the words of Dogen Zenji, a 13th century Zen master, he has this idea of all inclusive, you know, and I think that, you know, our definition of normal could certainly be more inclusive.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ruth Ozeki about her newest novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness. But as you spoke, I also thought of another aspect of the prism with which you examine this issue of what is real and normal. And that is, well, the objects themselves, not just the book, but the objects themselves in the book, even, let's say, refrigerator magnets, refrigerator poetry magnets, they're animated. They it seems that Benny is picking up something that's real about them. He's picking up the history that they lived through, their own experience. And it seemed to me that you're reminding us to pay attention to the real world that we are ignoring.
Mm-hmm.
To our own destruction, you know, the real world, which you divide into the made and the unmade. Well, the unmade is just as real as the made, but we seem to only be able to see or hear the made.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's absolutely right. You know, I think as children, we know this, right? As children, we hear objects speaking to us. We understand that matter is vibrant. You know, to use the words of the philosopher Jane Bennett, she has a wonderful book called Vibrant Matter. And, you know, matter is vibrant, right? And in that sense, it has its own aliveness, right? And we lose, you know, and so children sense this. And I think that's why, for example, in animated cartoons, objects speak all the time, right? I'm thinking of, what is it, SpongeBob, you know? Anyway, you know what I mean. Objects are constantly speaking. And I think that's because it's more, you know, that's closer to the way a child perceives the world, right? And we lose touch with that. We're socialized out of that. Other cultures don't, but our culture certainly socializes us out of that. You know, there are shamanistic cultures, you know, like, for example, in Japan, you know, there's an indigenous shamanistic religion, Shinto, and, you know, objects are animate. You know, they have lives and they need to be taken care of very carefully and respected, right? And I think we could use a little bit more of that, you know, in Western culture, because ours is a very, you know, consumer capitalism, you know, and the kind of materialist culture does not really support that view of the world, right? Sort of obsolescence is built into most of our objects, whereas in Japan, you know, objects are treasured over many generations, right? And I think it's a very beautiful way to experience the world. And I kind of wanted to explore that as well.
Beautiful and necessary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because, you know, Annabelle's job, you know, kind of locks her into absorption with the consequences of our inattention to the unmade world. You know, it isn't, there is the background of climate disaster in this book, of war, of the election of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, boy, when it brought me back to it. You know, I remember sitting on the New York City subway the day after the election, and there was dead silence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were shocked. And and you could feel it, and you really brought me back to that. But it's precisely the inattention that's causing all of this.
Exactly. I think that's true. And you know, so the idea that you know, that we can pay attention to the material world in a different kind of way is something that I wanted to explore. And I think, you know, I started thinking about this when I was cleaning out my parents' house, you know, and we all have to do some version of this at some point. And suddenly we're confronted with all of these objects, you know, that belong to our parents. And each of these objects has some kind of story attached to it. And, you know, it contains the story, right? And sometimes we know what that story is. Sometimes we have no idea what it is. But I think, you know, often we find ourselves just wishing that the object could tell us, could talk and tell us what, you know, where it came from and who touched it and who did it belong to and what did it see over the course of its lifetime. You know, these are, you know, sort of questions that arose in my mind when I was, you know, when I was doing that very, very difficult job. And then I started thinking too about how, you know, it's not just sentimental objects that hold, you know, stories, that all objects hold stories, particularly made objects, right? They hold the stories of their makers. And so something as simple as a running shoe has been handled and interacted. There's so many different lives that have interacted with that one object, right? And if you imagine all of those lives kind of constellating around that object, it becomes a very complicated and kind of crowded, lively place, right? That one shoe. You know, I mean, it's fanciful in a way, but it's also, and it's metaphoric in a way, but it's also not. It's also quite literal. And I wanted to sort of explore that in the book. And hopefully, you know, ask people to, you know, sort of reevaluate the way that they interact with the world.
Exactly. And then there's this whole, you mentioned before some of the guides on this hero journey to Benny and his mother, Annabelle, the Aleph, the teen who he met in the psych ward, Slavoj, the poet. Another one is Icon, who is a wonderful, a Marie Kondo-like character who is a Zen priest. She writes a book in order to save the you know, she goes to learn how to be a Zen monk at a Zen temple that is falling apart, and she writes a book called Tidy Magic, the radical Zen art of clearing your clutter and revolutionizing your life. I mean, just deconstructing that title, pretty radical, actually. So talk a little bit about Icon.
Sure. Yeah, she's a funny character. I mean, of course, yes, she's inspired by, you know, by Marie Kondo. And you know, Marie Kondo's, you know, the kind of animism in her tidying practices, you know, I found them very moving. You know, the idea that you would, before you throw something out, you would touch it, right? And you would, you know, you would thank it for its service, right? And this really comes from the Japanese cultural tradition that I spoke of earlier. You know, for example, if you have a sewing needle, you know, or a pin, and certainly now these things, these objects are easy to come by, but in olden times, you know, a pin or a needle was really a precious object, right? And you use it to sew clothes for your family. And eventually, you know, when it breaks, you don't just throw it away, you save it. And once a year, you take it to, you know, the shrine or the temple, and there's a special service for broken pins and needles. And they, you know, they have a block of tofu on the altar, and you put your pin or your needle into that block of tofu so that it will have a soft place to end up, right? It'll have a soft resting place after all of the service it's done for you. And this is a very practical thing too, because, you know, you don't want to get the spirit of that needle angry at you, because it could hurt you, right? So especially sharp objects, right? And pointed objects, you want to be very careful with and make sure that they have a nice resting place. So this is sort of the background against which the Icon character sort of grew. And, you know, it was a way of connecting Annabelle with, well, I also like the idea of a book within a book, you know, this idea of a kind of recursive narrative structure. It was something that appealed to me. And, you know, it gave me a chance to kind of explore these ideas using a slightly different lens And so that's really how the icon character developed. You know, she also spends time taking care of her teacher, her elderly teacher who's dying. And so that becomes, you know, a part of the book as well. You know, how does a lineage get carried on? What do we save and what do we discard, right? And so these are all, you know, what's our relationship with the past, right? What's our relationship with ritual and with funeral? I mean, one of the problems is, you know, the book starts with a death, but for various reasons, Annabelle and Benny decide not to have a funeral, right? So the book starts with a death and it ends with a funeral. And so this idea of what, you know, what is the role of these kinds of rituals in our lives is something else that I thought was interesting.
So the book, as you say, the book itself is a character. Mm-hmm. And at some point it says everybody has a book, but most don't hear it because they're too busy checking their cell phones. So there's the, there's the idea of, you know, our lack of attention. What does it mean when people don't hear their book?
Well, you know, there is that expression, right? Everyone's got a book in them, right? And I think that's true. I think that everyone does have a story, but it's a question of, do you take the time to listen to that story? Do you take the time to investigate and explore and write down that story? And that's, you know, I think, if, you know, for me, that's a lifeline. Learning to tell stories and investigating my own stories is what keeps me going. So, you know, I think that Benny finds this to be true as well. So it's something that, you know, I've certainly shared with the protagonist of this story. I think it's important. I think it's important to understand, you know, who we are and where we come from and why we choose the things that we do.
To listen to the book that's in us.
Yes.
Well, Ruth Ozeki, we could go on, but we can't.
It's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Yes, and this book is so wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure. I hope to talk to you again sometime soon.
Ruth Ozeki teaches creative writing at Smith College and is affiliated with the Brooklyn Zen Center and the Everyday Zen Foundation. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to read an excerpt from the book of Form and Emptiness. After the break, we talk with Hilma Wallitzer about her collection of stories, Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. When nonagenarian writer Hilma Wallitzer and her husband came down with COVID last year, she couldn't anticipate the season of grief it would bring, nor that the way out of that grief would be led by a book. Wallitzer survived, but her husband did not. Wallitzer's daughter, the writer Meg Wallitzer, suggested her mother put together a collection of her short stories that Hilma had written over the decades. It was meant as a way to deal with her loss. The stories are linked. They're about a married couple, Polly and Howard, and the course of their marriage over a lifetime. Their life together is ordinary, but the writing is not. Wallitzer wields her pen masterfully, illuminating her characters and their motivations with, as one reader, Lauren Goth, put it, wit, with rage, with grief, with the kind of prose that makes you both laugh and thrill to the darker, spikier emotions just barely visible under the bright surface. Hilma Wallitzer is the author of 13 novels, including 4 for young readers and a book of nonfiction. Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket is her first collection of stories. Well, Hilma Wallitzer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
I so loved these stories, very much linked stories, not all of them linked, but most of them were. Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. Most of them are related in that they are about a couple, Polly and Howard. just let's dive right in and tell us a little bit about Pauli and Howard.
Well, they just entered my head. I always start with a voice. At the risk of sounding like Joan of Arc, I hear a voice in my head and the character speaks to me and sort of tells me the story. I really don't know what's going to happen until I start writing it. So it keeps me curious about the characters, too.
Yeah, the first story is not about this couple, and it is such an incredible way to start this book. And a very evocative story. Talk a little bit about this. Tell us about this story.
Well, it's my very first published story. The title, I know, is a mouthful, and I was worried about it even fitting on a dust jacket, but the Bloom Fairy people really made it work, and especially with my long mouthful of a name as well. I feel that the story is the actual things that happen in it. A woman has a nervous breakdown in a supermarket. Another woman observes it and tries to help her. But I also think it becomes a kind of metaphor for the way many women felt about their lives in that period, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, about certain restraints on their lives and certain limits. I myself was raised by a housewife to be a housewife. So I'm a very late bloomer as a feminist and as a writer, actually. And I enjoyed my domestic life very much. And as you can see, it became fodder for my writing. But I also felt there had to be something more. And the something more turned out to be writing about it.
You were a late bloomer, but you did write your first published piece at the age of 9.
Yes. That, unfortunately, was not a worldwide publication. It was, I belonged to something at school called the Junior Inspectors Club, which was sponsored by the Department of Sanitation. And they had a mimeographed publication in which I had my first story published. And my mother and I were invited down to the Department of Sanitation, where I got to shake hands with a man behind a desk and receive a certificate, which I no longer have. But it seemed very wonderful, and the streets were lined with garbage trucks.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. That's just great. You know, what really strikes me about these stories, and you have a foreword by Elizabeth Strout, by the way, who does a wonderful appreciation of you. She's one of my favorite writers, and in a way...
Mine too.
And in a way, you write in kind of the same genre. She also does linked short stories. But she says that you once told an interviewer, "I don't believe there's such a thing as ordinary life. I think all life is extraordinary." I want to ask you about that statement, but it so rang true when I read it because these stories really show the marvelous voice. You hear the voice of Pauli. Her interior life, which is anything but ordinary, the language is extraordinary, and yet it's a very ordinary life. So talk about that tension between those two ideas.
I've always felt that way, that all life is extraordinary. I look out the window and I see people going by and traffic and the weather, and it's all glorious and interesting and mysterious. And I see people sitting across from me at the bus and I wonder about their lives and what they're thinking about. I had a psychiatrist friend, and I once told her that I thought everybody had an interesting interior life. And she said, "No, they don't," which really surprised me.
But then you create that interior life.
Well, the characters reveal themselves to me. I know it's sort of a mysterious process. I'm not sure quite how it works, but I get the characters first. I envision them physically, emotionally, intellectually, in every possible way. Once one of my books was being optioned for a movie, and the fellow who optioned it asked me who I envisioned playing the part of the main character. And I never envisioned a particular actress playing it. I envisioned that character and the way I saw her, you know, with a certain way she held her head and a certain way that she walked and twirled her hair while she was on the telephone, little habits. I saw the complete character.
And you say it's a mysterious process. Indeed. Could you say a little bit more about that and how that character does reveal itself to you?
Well, again, the voice of the character comes into my head. And I have to say that I will hear a line. I will start with a single line, the way poets very often do, and hope that another line follows and another line follows. But it doesn't always work out. And I have as many as 150 pages of what I consider a failed novel, but it's all not a complete loss because writers are thrifty and some of these passages could be used somewhere else.
So this is kind of a long conversation with this couple over many decades, from 1971, I guess, to, I mean, 1966 is the first story, but Howard and Polly appear in 1971, go all the way up to the present day. Could you let us in on kind of that long evolution of and development of that conversation?
Well, I thought about them a lot. The characters just continue to live in your head. I say sometimes they should be paying rent. They stay there. And of course, I had this big hiatus between the last published story about them and the newest published story about them. But I did think about them. They seem to be friends or neighbors who had moved out of the neighborhood. And I wondered what happened to them. And in writing the new story, which came surprisingly quickly and whole, I suddenly realized that I hadn't forgotten about them, that really, my curiosity about them was sustained, and my interest in them was sustained.
And, you know, of course, in the last story, which takes place in 2020, during the pandemic, you make reference to Howard's, you know, lifelong hypochondria and, you know, his uneasiness with death. But it's so much more salient in that story. It really does appear before this. I mean, this is not a new theme in these stories. Polly also faces fears, but she has a very different way of dealing with them. Talk about how Polly confronts her fears and Howard.
Well, I have to say that I assigned the hypochondriac to Howard, but I'm probably an informed hypochondriac myself. I was raised in a non-literary household, and the books I remember were a very ancient encyclopedia and a Dr. Morris Fishbein's home medical advisor. So I think I became a hypochondriac way before I became a writer. But this story came, as I said, more directly out of my own life, even though I assigned the experiences to characters who are not my husband and myself. My husband and I both contracted COVID-19 at the beginning of the pandemic. He had it first. I caught it. We were hospitalized in different separate hospitals, and he died 2 days before I came home. And it was quite a devastating experience. The loss of someone you've been married to for 68 years is very hard by itself. The hardest part was his disappearance. It wasn't just that he died. He seemed to have vanished because nobody visited him while he was ill. Nobody saw him off when he was cremated. Nobody came to visit me after he died and after I came out of the hospital. It was a very, very strange time. And when I came home, his shoes were still next to the bed. And as I said in the story, his toothbrush was still in the holder. And it didn't seem real. It seemed real and it seemed surreal at the same time. And it took me a longer time, I think, to accept what had happened, to truly realize it, than it would have had he died a more natural death with people who loved him and who he loved around him and around me at that time. So it was a very dark and difficult time. And I was still feeling quite ill from the virus. And my younger daughter, Meg, came up with the idea of collecting these stories. This was not my idea. And she even petitioned my agent about it. And lo and behold, they're being published. And At first I was not terribly interested. I was in mourning and not feeling well either. And then suddenly I realized I needed something to do and I needed something to look forward to. I think everybody needs that in their lives. Something to do, something to occupy you in every way, and something to look forward to.
You said before that your husband's passing from COVID, when you came home, it seemed so unreal and yet so very real. And that tension, I so recognize that. I say more about that.
Well, I knew he was gone. I mean, certainly I was told on the phone by one of my children that he had died in the other hospital. And that was 2 days before I came home, as I said. And then I came home and I can't say I expected to see him, but I wanted to see him. I wanted to talk to him. I never even had a chance to say goodbye to him. As in the story, as in my life, the paramedics came and he could not walk. He was handicapped to begin with, and he had difficulty in walking, but he couldn't walk at all when he was struck with COVID. And they had to come in and lift him and put him on a stretcher. And they began shouting instructions at me. I was masked. They were masked. And I hardly understood what they were saying, but they were saying, get his pajamas, get his comb, get his phone, get his charger. And I was running around looking for all these things while they were carrying him out. And I ran out after them into the hallway. We live in a high rise in Manhattan on the 18th floor. And they rang for the elevator. And the elevator came. And I realized I never said anything to him. I never touched him. I never said goodbye. I never said, I love you, till after the door closed. So that struck me very deeply. And writing about it in such a realistic way turned out to be cathartic for me. It was almost as if I made it happen, the things that didn't happen.
Oh, that's so moving. That's so wrenching, too. You know, it did strike me, the language was very different from all the other stories. I mean, it was much more direct. In the other stories, there's so much delight the reader takes in the turn of the phrase. I mean, you're a wonderful writer.
Thank you.
Talk about how your writing itself developed over the period of all those decades.
Well, I had stops and starts. I say I'm a late bloomer, but I'm not a perennial. I have to keep planting myself all the time. And at one point, I had a 12-year hiatus where I didn't write. A lot happened in my life during that period. I think both of my parents became very old and ill and died. I became ill. But I can't blame that on anything else. If you don't write, it's your fault. And it took me a while to break out of that. And I had the help of a really wonderful agent, Henry Duneau, who I wrote 4 pages. And he said, send them to me. And hardly any agent wants to read 4 pages of a novel. But I sent them to him. And he said, I really like them. Send me 4 more next week. And he had me send him weekly. It was almost like a serialized novel, the way Dickens published his stories in newspapers, his novels in newspapers. And eventually I had a whole novel and it had to be almost urged out of me. But as soon as I had a contract and I had a 2-book contract, the second novel came very quickly because I'm still one of the good girls who, if I promise something, I try to keep that promise.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Hilma Wallitzer about her retrospective collection of short stories, Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. So your daughter, Meg, is also a writer, which put me in mind of Jean Ray, who is also the mother of Ann Patchett. Did she write a lot as a child? Is this something that you feel you really passed on to her?
I think she was born a writer. I really do. She published her first story when she was 11 in something called Kids Magazine. And then she became an editor at the magazine. And we went into the city. We lived in the suburbs. And I sat in the waiting room like a stage mother while she sat in an office on the phone with people she was interviewing. But she also just was a natural writer. I think you'd have to ask her if I had any influence on her as a writer. We once did a mother-daughter book tour. We had books published at the same time, and the publishers had the idea of sending us out together on a mother-daughter book tour. And it was so much fun. I love being with her anyway. She's not just a wonderful writer. She's a terrific daughter. We had a lot of fun, but we realized that our throats hurt from talking about ourselves. And at one point, we wondered what Tolstoy and his mother would say on a book tour. And we couldn't come up with an answer.
That's wonderful. So these stories also very much reflect the time in which they take place. And as you said before, or we said before, you're 91 now. You sound a lot younger. I'm not looking at you because we're doing this on audio. As you put these pieces together, were there any reflections that you made on your own life? Just seeing how society has changed since the time that you became a young mother and the time of that we are now here in the pandemic.
The stories are of their time. And I mean, there are no computers, there are no cell phones. The women are all very domestic. They're busy making jello molds, as I did. But I also think that they're interior lives, their inner lives, their yearning is timeless. I think that women have felt this way as these women do in the stories throughout the centuries. And it's been expressed in different ways, sometimes privately, sometimes publicly, sometimes in movements like the Me Too movement. But I think that women have felt this way for a long time. And certainly my characters feel that way.
And you say, when did you become a feminist?
I think with the second wave of feminism. And that also helped me very much with my writing, because I felt that the feminists gave me permission to be a writer, to break out of that domestic aura that I was in. I have to say, I enjoyed my domestic life, and I was very creative in it in ways that probably drove my family insane. Nobody could get a store-bought Halloween costume, for instance, and I'm sure my kids lusted after those scratchy princess costumes, and instead they had to go as the Headless Horseman or something else I had created. And when they had birthdays, I made birthday cakes from scratch, and I decorated them until they collapsed. And I really think that everybody was a little relieved when I found another outlet for my creativity.
Yeah, I remember when you say second wave, that's as opposed to the first wave, which was the suffragettes, right?
Yeah, and The Feminine Mystique was an important book. And of course, reading other writers, other women writers. As I say, I was late to come to it, but once I was there, I also became more politically active. I began working for candidates, most of them losing, but still it was exciting. And I felt that I was more in the world without having really deserted my family or my home.
Who were the feminist writers who inspired you into the movement?
Well, Betty Friedan, though I have some questions about her. Alex Kate Shulman was a writer I admired. Grace Paley, very much so. I love the little disturbances of man. And I had the opportunity to meet Grace a few times. And once when I was campaigning outside a subway station for a losing presidential candidate, and Grace came up out of the subway, put her arms around me and said, "Good for you, good for you," which was so encouraging.
So was that in the 1970s
I believe so, 70s or 80s. I'm not sure now. Everything sort of melds together. When you get to be this old and you've had this much experience, it's hard to separate the decades.
It's true. And they go by so much faster.
Yes. No, I love when younger people say, "Does time move as slowly for you as it does for me?" And I remember that feeling of time just melting slowly and the luxuriousness of all that time ahead of you. But I must be nuts because I'm incorrigibly optimistic. I'm still looking forward. And despite several things that I feel are wrong with the world right now, I can't wait to see what happens. And I'm hoping that better things happen.
Really? What brings you to that optimism? Is it just constitutional?
I think it is. And I think it's familial. My parents were wonderfully optimistic. I realize now that I was raised during the Depression. We had very little money. We all lived together. We were a three-generation household with my grandparents. But I remember a lot of laughter and a lot of feeling of joy and of looking forward. And I think that affected me deeply. And I'm grateful to them. And I'm also grateful to them for, despite the lack of books in the household, for the oral tradition. They told the most wonderful stories. It was so good that I wish I had known them when they were children. And they weren't the happiest stories, but they were fascinating. My father had been an immigrant. My mother was born in the United States. She had to quit school in the eighth grade and go to work because her mother was ill. They talked about working in factories, about the sign that said, "If you don't come in on Sunday, don't come in on Monday." So they weren't always happy stories, but they were compelling to me. And they taught me about the shape of stories. I used to lie under the kitchen table and listen to them. And they spoke in Yiddish and they spoke in English. And occasionally they spoke in Pig Latin so that I wouldn't understand it. I think I quote that in one of the stories where the parents say, "Ixnay, the idke."
Right. And for our listeners, what does that mean?
Nix, the kid. Don't talk about it. The kid is listening. And of course, this kid was listening all the time. And so there are fragments from my life and fragments of real dialogue in the stories, though I don't recreate any characters. Howard is not my husband. I am not Paulie. The mother in the story says some of the things my mother said, but my mother was not like that. She was wonderful. She was kind. She was deeply affectionate. But she did say things like, "All cats are gray in the dark," about sex. And she did say, well, she was a wonderful Mrs. Malaprop as well. She once said to a young man, my sister had broken up with a young man, and my mother said to him, "Don't worry, one girl is better than two in a bush." Or she dropped him like a baked potato.
That's great. And you said they taught you the shape of stories. What do you mean by that?
Well, listening to them, there always seemed to be a beginning, a middle, and an end to their stories. The family sat around the table a great deal, not only the three generations with whom I lived, but aunts and uncles from both sides of the families would come too. And people would start to talk about something. They were full of remembrances, and they would remember the whole thing. And everybody chimed in. And I began to see the shapeliness of the story, that a thing happened. It happened in a day or it happened in a week. And I began to see it as a whole thing, as an entity. I envisioned their lives as they spoke about them.
Yes. Now, you recently wrote a piece for the East Hampton Star, which is my local paper.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. A book review, Keeping Secrets by Bina Bernard. Who are some of the favorite writers that you are reading now or books that you'd like to recommend?
Well, anything by Jenny Diske, who unfortunately died, and I feel very much like Holden Caulfield when he said he wished he knew a writer so he could call him up and speak to him. Jenny Diske died at 68, and her essays are funny and very moving. I wish I could have known her. I love Chimamanda Adichie. Americana is a wonderful book. I do love Evan Cannell, Mrs. Bridge and Mr. Bridge, which I refer to in the final story in the collection, are two of my favorite novels. I like Sally Rooney. I like Nathaniel West, The Day of the Locust, but especially Miss Lonely Hearts. And I like the British writer Henry Green very much.
And I'm so grateful to you because, you know, I confess this was an introduction to your work. I'm eager to go and read the rest of your work. It's such a wonderful book of stories. Today, A Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. It's been such a privilege to talk with you, Hilma Wolitzer. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca, for having me.
Hilma Wolitzer. Find a link to her blog at writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with David Steben about his book, Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America. And Victor Wooten tells us about his allegorical novel, The Spirit of Music. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.